Welcome back to the final session of the day. So in this final session, we have two events. The last event is due to finish at 5:15, but we thought, I know some people may have to run for trains, but we could allow 15 minutes at the end of the day just for any last kind of thoughts or observations or questions that may have been brewing in you during the day, just for a little at the end of the day. Just to say some of these things now, which is if there are cups and things you have, if you can gather any of those things and bring them out with you at the end, that is very welcome. In our next session, we have Dr. Soen Park. She teaches literature at Oxford University, and her talk is on memory and the new unconscious. Please welcome Soen Park. And I thought you were mic'd, but you're not. Sorry.
So I'll start again. Thank you very much to Jerry, Judith and Ivan for inviting me. It's great to be here. So Memory and the New Unconscious is the title of my talk. And I'll begin by talking about how writers and artists and poets begin their work, and when you ask them how it is that their work came about, a lot of them will often say, I don't know. They'll say the beginning of the work, the conception, is nothing like as concrete as an idea, but something more on the level of a glimmer or a throb or a recognition. The writer has to push ahead into the dark, holding the glimmer like a candle, and just feel out the options. At this point, do not try to think consciously, advised Rudyard Kipling, based on his experience of writing The Jungle Book. He counseled, drift, wait, obey. More radically, Harold Pinter described the genesis of The Homecoming and Old Times. Quote, I have often been asked how my plays come about. I cannot say, nor can I ever sum up my plays, except to say that this is what happened, that is what they said. Most of the plays are engendered by a line, a word, or an image. The given word, which comes right out of the blue into my head, is often shortly followed by the image. The first line of The Homecoming is, what have you done with the scissors? The first line of Old Times is dark. In each case, I had no further information. In each case, I found myself compelled to pursue the matter. This happened visually, a very slow fade through shadow into light. Something appearing right out of the blue is one of the most abiding images we have of the creative process. It points to the evident connection between creativity and the unconscious, but since the unconscious is not accessible to our conscious awareness, elaborating the range of its phenomena with any conceptual precision is elusive. So it's vaguely expressed as a hunch, a premonition, a sense of things. More commonly, especially in the pre-modern period, it was metaphorized as muse, demon, or supernatural inspiration. The range of metaphors hardened into a philosophical and scientific concept in the 19th century. Of course, prominent ideas about the unconscious can be traced all the way back to Hippocrates, and the word unconscious came into use at the same time as consciousness in the 17th century. But it's around the middle of the 19th century that we begin to see a substantial number of references to it in medical and philosophical publications, and to witness the emergence of the unconscious as an object of scientific investigation. Between the 1870s and the 1930s, or what we might call the first age of modern research into the unconscious, there was a proliferation of models of unconscious processes. The most notable developments came out of and were situated within the German philosophical tradition and French dynamic psychiatry. But whether we're looking at the elaborations of the subconscious in the ideas of Franz Mesmer, or the automatic writing thesis of Pierre Janet, or whether we're tracing it back with reference to Kant, Goethe and Schopenhauer, the unconscious in this first phase tends to culminate in the psychoanalytic models of Freud. And running through the range of the models are threads of shared assumptions, three of which I will risk picking out. The first is that the unconscious during this period was defined in relation to various ideas of consciousness and was configured as part of a binary. The second is that unconscious processes were generally given primary agency over the conscious mind, that the unconscious knew more, it knew better, and so on. And the third is that the dynamic between the unconscious and conscious was generally conceived in terms of either electromagnetism or more often pressure, especially hydraulic pressure, so repression, suppression, and control were foundational concepts. These are the common threads that we have inherited, and they're deeply interwoven into how we view ourselves, literature, and culture today. So influential is the psychoanalytic legacy that it is routinely accepted that the modern subject is divided, that the unconscious is a repository of deeper truths, and that it is at the level of the unconscious that we can really make sense of ourselves and our society. And these basic principles have yielded powerful interpretive models such as the collective unconscious, the linguistic unconscious, the political unconscious, the post-colonial unconscious, and so on. Nevertheless, there have been questions raised about the ontological instability of the concept. In psychology, the rise of behaviorism all but eclipsed the psychoanalytic model by the middle of the 20th century. Likewise, in philosophy, logical positivism discredited the unconscious as that which is unfalsifiable. In this climate, Karl Popper famously dismissed psychoanalysis as a pseudoscience. And to an extent, this scepticism remains today. For example, Angus Nichols at Queen Mary, in his 2010 study, Thinking the Unconscious, questions whether the unconscious, quote, actually exists objectively and independently of its theoretical elaborations, end quote. For Nichols, the unconscious is more metaphor than scientific concept, and if one speaks of it at the level of concept, then it is a concept that creates its own object. That is to say, the background framework surrounding the unconscious pre-exist the specifics, and it's only during the act of narration that the unconscious emerges into an entity. In this view, the unconscious is a classic case of an effect produced by the discourse which purports to investigate it. Meanwhile, in the last 40 years, a different line of thinking about the unconscious has emerged from altogether elsewhere in the field of neuroscience, developing what we might call the cognitive unconscious. Crucial to the advances of the field was the discovery in the 1980s in neuroscience of unconscious perception and unconscious memory, which established empirically that very little of what goes on in the brain is available to awareness. The cognitive unconscious offers a significantly different model from the psychoanalytic unconscious. But in spite of the differences, the cognitive angle has successfully reinstated the unconscious as a legitimate scientific topic, including the earlier models of the unconscious developed around the turn of the last century. But there are huge differences, and the main differences, again, I'll pick out three. First, the cognitive unconscious is not defined in relation to consciousness, but investigated as a part of a variety of mental processes. The structure of the mind is thus not binary, but modular. Second, unconscious processes are not given agency over the conscious mind, but are seen as working together in parallel and in combination. And third, the dynamic between the unconscious and conscious is not one which is hydraulic or magnetic, but a relation of connected networks. To elaborate, the modular view of brain and mind proposes that there are specific regions and specialized neural circuits for carrying out particular functions, and that they work independently of one another as well as in parallel. So for a basic example, we often hear about the four lobes of the brain, which gives rise to mind, as having certain features we associate with them. The frontal lobe for thinking, planning, and moving, the occipital lobe with seeing, the temporal lobe for remembering an emotion, and the parietal lobe with spatial function. More concretely, the modularity of the human brain is illustrated by five senses. Vision, hearing, taste, touch, and smell. Annie Cattrell's sculpture Sense shows fMRI scans of the brain converted into three-dimensional structures of amber resin as the subject experiences each of the senses, and it's on permanent display in the Wellcome Collection. To probe deeper into how the unconscious features in this modular view of the brain, I would like now to discuss two landmark discoveries in neuroscience that are relevant to the cognitive unconscious. First, Mort Mishkin and Leslie Ungerleider, who are at NIH's work on the visual pathways, and second, the taxonomy of memory charted by Larry Squire at UCSD. Before I begin, I should say that I won't have time to discuss the experiments themselves, but only to draw upon their conclusions. The details of the experiments that led to this model of the brain that I'm about to outline can be found in this definitive guide, Memory from Mind to Molecules, by Larry Squire and Eric Kandel. Eric Kandel won the Nobel Prize for his work on memory. This is a figure showing Leslie Ungerleider's discovery of the what and the where pathways. Even a simple perceptual process, like recognizing a pointer, for example, involves information about the outer world traveling from the retina to the thalamus, which is where four of the five senses go, arriving first in the visual cortex area V1, so at the back of the brain in the occipital lobe V1. What Mishkin and Ungerleider discovered was that the information is then channeled through two pathways, so the parietal where pathway and the temporal what pathway, the top stream and the bottom stream. The top dorsal stream is devoted to spatial processing, passing information about where the object is by neurons that respond to movement and location. Through the bottom ventral stream, which are areas that specialize in object processing about what the object is by neurons that respond to information about size, color, and orientation. Information about the what, the object, the what and the where, moves in series and in parallel, feeding forward to the frontal lobe to link to action, to the limbic areas for emotion processing, to the medial temporal lobe for memory, and so on and so forth. All of this, recognizing an object, is achieved in less than 50 milliseconds. Arrestingly, they discover that the information that travels through the where pathway, so through the parietal top stream, is for the significant part inaccessible to consciousness. It is primarily unconscious, while information in the what pathway is chiefly conscious. So even a cognitive task as apparently simple as visual recognition, which takes milliseconds, entails the integration of conscious and unconscious processes to complete it. Every conscious experience we have is actually the result of a background of unconscious processes. Or put in another way, unconscious processes pervade our conscious experience at every level. In addition to being separate and modular, we can see that the perceptual pathways presented in Ungerleider's figures are connected. So they go backwards and forwards. You can see the arrows. Which takes me to the second difference between the two models, the psychoanalytic and the cognitive. The model of mind proposed here is a connected system of networks, not a hydraulic system founded on pressure. The pathways in this figure, as you can see, are reciprocal. Information is fed backwards as well as forwards. That is to say, perception isn't just a passive detection of stimuli in the brain. For the information to be experienced as perception, the brain organizes the fragmented stimuli into a coherent whole. Different neural structures connect with each other, reconstructing the incoming data in the light of memories acquired through prior experiences to enable us to gauge the meaning and value of the information. So the eyes are not just telling the brain information about the what and the where of the object, but the brain is also telling the eyes, as it were, what it is you're looking at and how you should feel about it. So to summarize, the information pathways are not only modular but connected. And building on perception to memory, if we think of memory as an extension of perception and experience, we find that neuroscience also figures memory as modular and connected. This is Larry Squire's map of the long-term memory system, where he classifies the different kinds of memory. Long-term memory is divided into different systems that are separate and independent with distinct neuroanatomical structures that support them. For example, neurons specific to the declarative memory system in the hippocampus are these hippocampal pyramidal neurons. They're our friends who help us remember. Memory, as Squire writes, quote, is not a single entity, but is composed of different systems. Only one of these systems is accessible to awareness, the declarative memory system. So long-term memory, you've got the implicit non-declarative memory, declarative explicit memory for facts and events in the hippocampus area. Only this system is available to awareness. All the other systems with their underlying structures are inaccessible. So what are these things? Skills and habits. Procedural memory are skills and habits which are striatum related. So they're things like they're all the kind of skills and habits so that we know how to do things without having to think how it is that we know how to do them. For example, motor skills like riding a bicycle or swimming, texting, typing, what we normally call muscle memory would be striatum related. Perceptual skills like looking in the mirror and understanding that the left and the right are reversed immediately without thinking. Reading numbers, reading music. There are also everyday habits like putting on the left shoe before the right for certain people or buttoning up the shirt from bottom to top. And there's a great deal of research done on treating dysfunctional circuitry of the striatum for OCD, for excessive habits and so on and so forth. And priming, which is the ability to recognize a word or an object without actually realizing that you've seen it before, is distributed over the neocortex. Classic conditioning, pioneered by Pavlov, now includes emotional responses, emotional learning in the amygdala, which are things like fear, phobia, all kinds of preferences, including love and attachment, which are amygdala related. We have skeletal and muscular conditioning here in the cerebellum, which is kind of eye blink conditioning and so on and so forth. And then there's non-associative learning in the reflex pathways, which is habituation and sensitization. So habituation, not noticing the everyday background and the changes in them. For example, not noticing if a member of your family's got a haircut, or sensitization, being hyper-aware of something that's hurt you in the past, out of the context in which it has occurred. So all of these things will be expressed as a way of seeing and being in the world, not as a memory, but as instinct, as intuition, as personality. So what's significant about non-declarative memory in the context of this discussion is that doesn't seem like memory at all, but looks a lot more like what we would call the unconscious. But in contrast to the psychoanalytic model, the cognitive unconscious does not have the powers to twist and foil our conscious plans, nor does it necessarily protect our truest need, of which we remain unaware. It is more the whole aggregate of experience recollected in non-declarative form, less an entity that will return to haunt us with its semiotic and libidinous powers than a shape, which, like a riverbed formed by the accumulation of flow patterns, mould and guide our behaviour. Habits of thinking, habits of feeling, selective perception, behavioural inclination, patterns of reacting, the blindness and sensitivity of our personality can be recast in terms of different forms of non-declarative memory that we have accumulated over our lifetime. All of the memory a baby acquires is unconscious memory, which as a grown person she will experience as a disposition. If a 2-year-old boy is knocked down by a large dog, as a grown man, he will have no recollection of this incident, but he may have a fear of dogs, which he will understand as a personality trait, not as a memory. Pinter's very slow fade through shadow into light can be discussed as non-declarative memory shaping into consciousness, just as the array of metaphors of the unconscious, such as muse or demon, can be explored through the categories of different kinds of declarative and non-declarative memory systems. Even belief structures and value systems are now reconfigured as various blends of unconsciously acquired memory, as Squire and Kandel point out. People do not generally remember consciously the circumstances in which they acquire and assimilate the moral principles that govern their lives. Many of our dispositions and styles that make up our personality are acquired similarly as non-declarative knowledge. these principles and dispositions are acquired gradually and almost automatically, like the rules of grammar that govern our native language. If I were to point to the cardinal difference between the cognitive unconscious and the psychoanalytic unconscious, it would be the role of repression. By neuroscientific accounts, we fail to remember not because we have repressed our memories, as in the Freudian model, but because of factors like non-rehearsal, synaptic weakening, distraction, suggestibility, blocking, and so on, the seven sins of memory outlined by Dan Schachter. Sub-threshold conscious memory can manifest itself in slips, and studies show that conscious repression can indeed weaken memory. But these phenomena are given a tiny role in the overall cognitive picture. As you can see, Freud's pre-conscious included memory. It played a very tiny role. But far from playing a small role, as in the Freudian pre-conscious, memory is the new unconscious. Squire Candell writes, "These various forms of non-declarative memory are ancient in evolutionary terms. They're reliable and consistent, and they provide for myriad unconscious ways of responding to the world, in no small part by virtue of unconscious status of these forms of memory. They create much of the mystery of the human experience. Here arise the dispositions, habits, and preferences that are inaccessible to conscious recollection, but nevertheless are shaped by past events, influence our behavior and mental life, and are an important part of who we are." So I'll conclude by comparing the two models of the unconscious at the level of language. Instead of id, ego, and superego, we can discuss neural circuitry, systems, pathways. Repression can be refigured in terms of dysfunctional connectivity. Libido and jouissance can be rearticulated in terms of dopamine and oxytocin levels. Reward circuitry takes the place of the pleasure principle. Which is to point out that the conceptual frames that establish the two models clearly reflect the historical period. Freud's topographic model owes much to 19th century hydraulic engineering, which was regarded as the latest technological invention, as well as geosciences, which was one of the dominant disciplines of the day. So that's Freud's graph. It also reflects the repressive and hierarchical structures of 19th century European middle-class patriarchal family and the ideologies arising from it. The cognitive unconscious of the 21st century is no different in this regard, embodying the historical moment from which it emerges. That the brain should be cast in terms of hubs, networks, and information pathways is not surprising. After the digital revolution, the network is the predominant organizing metaphor of our time. From the neural network to the social network, connectivity captures the basic condition of the 21st century. In the post-patriarchal, anti-hierarchical, identity-performing, glocalized, US-centered liberal democracies of today, separate, independent modules connecting through connected networks is a paradigm that is applicable to a far wider sphere than just the brain. This is not to suggest that the cognitive unconscious is less legitimate for resonating in the culture of the 21st century, but the language in which the model is rendered does point to the fact that science emerges from specific historical and cultural conditions and will reflect those conditions even as it works to improve on them. As John Searle pointed out, the model of the mind has throughout history been figured in terms of the latest technology, from the ancient Greeks, who thought of the brain as a catapult, to Leibniz, who thought of it as a mill, to the Victorians, who likened it to the telegraph, to Freud's hydraulic and electromagnetic systems, to Daniel Dennett's early model of the mind as a television. Our model of how the mind works is inescapably geared to our times. The cognitive unconscious provides biological evidence that the very slow fade through shadow into light actually exists at the neural level, and it's not just a metaphorical construction. But how these processes are going to be conceptualized will be established by the figurative frames that make meaning possible. The frames change the way we see the processes. So the unconscious fluctuates between concept and metaphor, between the different levels of meaning, from being a product of the discourse as well as the kernel of being that gave life to it. Thank you.
Going to have maybe two questions now, and then maybe pick up some in 40 minutes' time. Does anyone have any questions there?
Thank you for an absolutely brilliant scientific explanation of the subject at hand. The implication of all this is that our understanding of the mind and brain is entirely dependent on our technological advances, which leaves us absolutely nowhere. So where do you see this all going? Is it entirely dependent on computer science, or is there hope for an ascetic, deeper, mystical understanding of how we perceive the world, and also how we resolve the deep neurotic and psychological problems that we're still coping with?
So thank you very much for that. I have a more optimistic outlook, is that it's quite true that science is a certain discipline that is only interested in the kind of problems it can answer. And we only get answers to the questions that we pose, and they tend to be extremely limited. On the other hand, with continual interventions by people like us, maybe better questions, more interesting questions, more profound questions can be raised, which takes me to... I run a series on unconscious memory in Oxford, and I was going to... I'll just bring it up here. If anybody would like to come and give a talk or collaborate, it's a forum for literary scholars or people in the humanities, artists, musicians, and neuroscientists, that we can build the bridge and begin to talk to one another. Thank you.
Okay, just really a sort of comment on, I think it was almost the last paragraph of your talk, which led to a great deal of laughter about the equality, the liberal democracy, worldwide networks and all the rest of it, which seemed to show how this particular model can rush straight into the ideology of the dominant West and completely ignore questions of power, control and everything else.
Yeah.
And so what would be interesting would be how would you translate an acute sense of intensifying hierarchy and inequality in the world today, and how would that reality get translated into the terms of social and neural networks? Because at the moment, it would seem that it would point in exactly the same direction. At least what Freud did was to recognize hierarchies, to talk about them, to talk about the way the world was going, civilization, its discontent, civilization and its destructiveness, and all the rest of it. It seems quite possible that contemporary neural talk just vanishes all that, and we're left with a completely ridiculous social model of complete equality and everybody being connected up.
Yeah. I mean, I entirely agree, and it's only through absolute vigilance and intervention that we can have a sense. Scientists are humans too, with human problems, through intervention, I think we can really open up the debate. And it's tremendous that science has actually, neuroscience has come towards the humanities, in the sense that people do think of the unconscious and emotion as serious objects of scientific investigation, where through behaviorism that was all relegated to the margins. So in a way, neuroscience has become a lot more positive in the sense that we can maybe build bridges. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. So, no, but the... Mike. So, while we mic up our final speakers,
okay.
A final session of the day. We have two poets. We have poet and psychotherapist Alan Buckley in conversation with poet Annie Freud. Annie's latest book, The Remains, is just out, and she's in fact on Start the Week on Monday. But you've got the run on everybody else. You can hear her now, live.
Can you hear? Can you hear? It sounds pretty good to me.
Is everyone ready?
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, off you go.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. We're both aware this is the last session of what has been a long, though very rich day. So I think we're going to try and ease you towards the end a little here. I do need to say, Judith said I'm a psychotherapist. I'm not actually a psychoanalyst. I'm actually a gestalt psychotherapist. So if the Freudian police come in and bundle me off in a sack, that's why. We're going to do something that sort of blends between a reading and conversation. So there will be Annie will be reading some poems, mainly from her new collection, The Remains, but we'll also be weaving in some conversation about the nature of dreams and the writing process. And just to lead into Annie's first bit of reading, something that came to my mind through the day was there's a wonderful, I guess like Annie, we're friends. We've had lots of conversations over the years about writing, and I think we're both lyric poets who subscribe to the idea that the lyric poem is a form of exploration for both writer and reader rather than a form of expression. And I was minded of a wonderful quotation from Wilfred Bion, who said that if there are not at times two frightened people in the consulting room, we will only discover what the world already knows. And I firmly believe that the same applies to the little room of the poem, which I think is a good place to hand over to Annie.
Thank you. I asked Alan to join me to do this because he's exceptionally intuitive and I'm very fond of him. That's not done. I'm going to start. I just want to say a few years ago I was at a talk with Lavinia Greenlaw and Paul Muldoon. Paul Muldoon said that when he writes poems, he doesn't know what he's doing. And there's lots of different ways you can interpret that phrase. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing. And I found, having written quite a few poems now, that I only know what I meant sometimes years after I've written a poem, and sort of read it lots of times, and suddenly I will discover what I was about. And so that means a lot to me, although it's something I don't think about and pursue it. It's just there as a sort of constant theme that I don't know what I'm doing. I want to start with a poem that's really about somebody who didn't know what he was doing. He was a very interesting and troubled man, a distant cousin of mine called Michael Wishart, a really important and interesting painter. And one of his very finest paintings, which you can go and see in the Warsaw Museum of Modern Art, is Moths on a Blue Path. It has extraordinary energy and sadness and beauty. And I'd like you sort of to imagine that it might be, I don't know, 1951 or 1952, just shortly after the end of the Second World War. And, you know, do you like boys or do you like girls? Can you make up your mind? Can't you? You're going to see your mother. What's it going to be like? You haven't got any money. What's going to happen? What are you going to do? You don't know what you're doing. Anyway, this is Moths on a Blue Path. Having drunk the half bottle of Crème de Menthe that you found in the drinks cupboard after breakfast, you drag along this path, your eyes fixed on the floor, scouring for treasure among the gaudy snail shells, empty acorn cups, and coiled trails left by the worms. It's the hush of a Sussex summer's day. You're done for the week and may stay longer. The studio rent's overdue, and the curtains have gone to the cleaners. Bobby's at the Cap d'Antibes, and the club is closed till September the 1st. Mother wrote full of enthusiasm about the new roses and has promised a trip to Rottingdean. What has made the moths come out in such numbers, streaking the grass with their silvery eyeshadow, beating their wings in hapless frenzy ungainly in the hour of death. You watch the train crossing the marsh and hope there's something nice for lunch. The monotonous greenness oppresses you. I'm going to read now something very different. This was a poem I thought, oh my God, I really want to write this poem. No, you can't. I really, really, really want to write this poem. Oh, no, you can't. And it was, I got sort of the idea from my mother's note. My mother died a few years ago, and I got her notebooks, and they're simply fantastic. And there are things like lists of romantic boys' names. I mean, what could be better than that? Lists of favourite French actresses. Lists of different kinds of coat that she intends to buy for herself. Anyway, sort of, so I inherited that. And this poem is sort of really about kind of precision and perfection and the way the French language has stolen, has made a kind of like an assault on the English language, and I absolutely love that. And there's other themes here too, but let's get a move on. It's called Les Sauces, Le Ballet, Les Actrices, Aurore, Gribiche, Messine, Armoricaine, Bordelaise, Verte, Parmentier, Diable, Poivre, Tatar, Meunière, Béchamel, Ravigote, Remoulade, Vierge, Madère, Mornay, Espagnol, Velouté, Nantua, Soubise, Dégagé, Écarté, Fondu, Glissade, Chassé, Jeté, Soubresaut, Fouetté, Attitude, tendue, entrechat, pirouette, arabesque, pointe. Pas de deux, pas de cheval, pas de poisson. Split, battement, plié. Signoret, Darieux, Simon, Morgan, Rosé, Feuillère, Chevreau. Demasiste, Moreau, Sérigue, Audran, Dorléac, Bardot, Deneuve. Cazares, Birkin, Huppert, Adjani. Miu Miu, Gainsbourg, Binoche. Okay, one more and then we'll talk about it. Yeah, yeah. Now, boom, 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 boom. This is another person who doesn't quite know what he's doing. And it's about that moment when you are obsessively in love with somebody who only tells lies. They don't do it deliberately, but just somehow like everything they say is an invention. Everything they do, everything they say. And it's the moment in which, having come to the conclusion, having reached that point of sort of wise understanding, the person that you're in love with screws it up. It's called Grenoble. He said goodbye to his friends and walked through the wet streets to the hotel. She was already asleep in her white lace nightdress with her back turned to him. The sight of her gold bangle and cigarettes on the desk, the magazine with the half-done puzzle, her burgundy jacket slung over the chair, and an airplane ticket sticking out of her bag gave him such a shock he almost cried out. He sat for a few minutes and thought about the husband about to stand trial for armed robbery and who needed her now, and realised he hadn't taken any of it seriously. He wondered about the trouble she always took with her appearance, especially when everything seemed to be going against her. But wasn't that something you could say about all women? And so, having no toothbrush with him and feeling quite squalid, he undressed and lay down next to her on his back. I am never going to forget this night, he thought. Here I am, after all, with her incredible loveliness. And as he was about to turn over, he felt her foot threading itself between his ankles, twisting sideways for better purchase, and pulling him close.
We were talking about this, and this power, which I think is fascinating on many levels, but one thing I wasn't aware of until we started talking about this was this fictive Annie, this alter ego persona that you use for this poem. And I wanted you to maybe share a little about that and how it works
in the writing
process.
Well, there are lots and lots of them. There is this woman whose main relationship is to her accoutrements. Her jacket, her shoes, her bag, her compact, maybe her tweezers. And these are more important at some level than anybody else. Or there's the man who travels. He's not particularly going anywhere, but he stops at various places, maybe small watering place, maybe a border town. Maybe he picks someone up or someone picks him up. Or he buys a magazine, and when he walks back into the life of my poet, it's always exciting because, you know, I'm sort of there kind of watching him go from cafe to cafe, kind of. And, you know, he's not getting any younger, this person, and I really like him. So there's lots of these kind of people.
What does he allow you to do? This guy who's... leading a sort of shadow or a sort of fetch life alongside you.
Well, he allows me to sort of pursue my own kind of moral dubiousness. you know, not being able to do right and be right as much as I'd like. I suppose one of the exciting things that I think Gombrich says that one of the purposes of art is where human awfulness is just unbearable in life. In Madame Bovary, it's rubies. It's like when people aren't sort of really, really good enough. It's kind of incredibly exciting and magical. You know, Aschenbach in Death in Venice, you know, you can't take your eyes off him. And yet he's, you know, flawed, flawed, flawed. That sort of thing.
I mean, the other thing that sort of really struck me reading this, reading Grenoble, was it seems very much of a piece with a lot of, as you say, the slightly sort of faded bohemian world of accoutrement and fine living that's just on the edge of collapse. And I wasn't sure whether to read it as sort of autobiographical or not, because actually the woman in it, who's this... strikes me as this deeply narcissistic and not very empathic woman. Actually, I just thought, well, this sounds a bit like your mum, I have to say.
Yeah, there's aspects of my mum in there.
There's certainly aspects.
Yes,
the man is ultimately ensnared. But, I think this what this then led me on to was what I saw as quite a repeated theme in your work, which is about the process of individuation, of Annie separating out from a very dominant and domineering sort of family and family heritage, and that this theme often seems to emerge in your writing in poems that are either specifically poems that are based on dreams, or that have a dream vision like quality to them, or also in found poems, which also have this great gift of offering us into the unconscious. And there was a beautiful line from I think we mentioned this in from a poem in The Remains, which actually wasn't a found poem or a dream poem, but it was a commissioned poem, which kind of like puts you up against your own unconscious very strongly when you get asked to do a poem.
Yes.
And it was about Mastermind, wasn't it?
Yes.
You sort of had to, you know, as we all do when we get commissioned poems, it's like, bloody hell, I've agreed to do this, and what on earth am I going to say? And then you write the poem and find out that actually it says something quite remarkable. And the lines that stood out for me in this is that I walk the diagonal path into the spotlight. And I thought, but this is Annie's life. You know, this is actually sort of what your life has been, that quite late in life you've become artistically recognised in your own right, and you've moved diagonally sort of from out of the shadow of this, this sort of, this name and this sort of mass of fantasy and history into your own right as a poet.
It was so nice when you pointed that out to me. I just hadn't seen it. You know, because, you know, in Mastermind, they, you know, there's an awful shadow and they creep forwards and they, you know, they try and get sort of, they have to sort of, you know, answer 10 questions on Dubliners or something, you know.
And I think following on from that, what we wanted to do was, there's a poem, a particular favourite of mine from your second collection, The Mirabelles, which I think it's not a dream poem, it's actually a biographical poem, but to me it has so much the quality of a dream that were one to present it in a therapy session, the therapist would be sort of rubbing their hands with glee, thinking this is going to be an easy money for interpreting this one. So this is a... this poem is called Monte Baldo.
Monte Baldo. What this poem is dealing with is a sort of a to and fro between a child's sense of being completely subject to the parent and also finding an extraordinary moment of self-sovereignty. And how important that moment was. There's lots more I could say about where the images come from. And that it's not, it's true, but it's not strictly factual. Anyway, this is Monte Baldo. She handed me my peasant costume colouring book and watched me fill the woman's bodice in with black, her bell-shaped skirt in blue and yellow stripes, the shepherd's jerkin and his breeches in a doggy brown. She leaned her shoulder into mine and filled the woman's lips in red and gave the man a massive green moustache. I saw how fine my mother's ankles were in their sheer stockings, her supple handmade moccasins, the bright numerals of her small black-faced wristwatch, inhaled the lemon smell of her cologne, revered her double rope of pearls, her accoutrements of calfskin, tweed and tortoiseshell, her strike against the disappointments of her life. I walked up to the counter. The waitress pointed to a door that led into the cellar, dark, wonderfully cool, and smelling of the earth, filled with boxes of tomatoes, and a yard like the bottom of a well, and at its end, the toilet in a tiny glassless window, high up on the wall. I sat down and saw a mountain magnified against the sky. She never told me why we stayed there for so long. Were we hiding from something or someone? She was the favourite with all the shopkeepers. Every week she'd have her hair done. It was too hot for me to leave our pensione. Most days she lay in bed looking at photos of Mastroianni and Lollobrigida.
So is there anything more you wanted to say on that sort of post-poem before I launch in with what came up for me in my therapeutic role?
It's just that that moment when in the darkness, in the cellar, with the boxes of tomatoes, it refreshes me today. I wrote that poem for myself.
I mean, and I think the thing that as I said, for me, the dreamlike quality of it is that is you going down into a cellar, which of course is the classic sort of metaphorical construct for the going into the unconscious.
Yes.
But it's dark, but it's cool, it's immensely fertile, there are these beautiful ripe tomatoes, it feels of the earth, it feels connected to the real world, it's a private space, and then there's this enclosed room, which I think of as being, very much like the enclosed room of a poem, and yet it gives you a vision to God.
Yeah.
And I just thought the whole poem as a sort of a poem of individuation and escape through art just seemed absolutely sort of perfect.
Oh, yeah. So nice to be.
Well, you know. As your therapist, that's what I'm paid for.
Shall I read a dream poem now?
I think so. This is a poem that poem that is actually straightforwardly written from a dream.
In this dream, I mention a painting by my father, Lucian Freud. It's called I can't remember now. It's houses. It's in Paddington. Just can't remember the title of it just now. And it's an absolutely remarkable painting, and it just comes into the poem. And I had no idea I was going to be writing about this. But what happened was, is I had a poem. Freudian slip, eh? Anyway, sorry. I had a dream in which I steps outside the house, and lying in the gutter just outside the house was a a little book, and it was sort of blackcurrant coloured, and it had yellow writing on it, and it was a book of poems written by me called Rare London Cheeses. And apparently quite a few writers dream of, but I had nothing published then, but lots of writers actually have that dream, that they get up and they find a book on the floor, and it's by them. Hey! And it's ready, you know. Anyway, this is the poem. Rarity must have been ordained to keep desire alive, and me, as I follow after a butterfly, looking forward to the moment when I'll recall its yellow, and this Saturday that will stay with me for nothing more than how the sun surprised me with its heat, and that the sea was a blue I'd never seen before. If I mention London, it's because of Delamere. The sadness in the backs of terraced houses, the chimney pots in attitudes of strife, the feathered discolorations of the render, and the way each window seems to be leading its own relentless Sicertian life. Cheese commands respect. It has ancestral status. It is aspirational and suggests a connoisseurship that would exasperate were it not born of greed. Be it swathed in muslin or dipped in ashes, it will change your humour. And London cheeses? How can I ever say what anything is like? Rare London Cheeses is the title of a book of poems that I picked up in a dream from the gutter of my street. I opened it and felt the jolt of publication as I scanned the intention and the scope of every line. A moment later, I awoke to find it wasn't there. Nor these words, nor my name along the spine.
So obviously we've got this wonderful sort of meta issue here, where you're writing a poem about not having yet been a published author, yet actually that poem is in your.
It's a bit Escherish, isn't it?
It's like but I mean, in terms of going, you said. As I think I certainly feel is true for my poems, I think a lot of other poets do, that you go back to your work months or years later and say, well, that was really about. What meanings have unfolded from that poem for you? I mean, because as you say, it has that, just as it stands, it has that sort of Escheresque quality of basically mashing your head up. But it also seems to have a much more kind of serious intent to it, to me anyway.
I suppose looking back on it, I suppose I feel I've made a sort of a work of art. And that feels really, really nice. Although at the time it felt like a little machine. You know, but that word was, but you know those little plastic things where you had a letter and you moved them around and it might say a word or might be a little sum or something. It felt like that writing it. It was a sort of box and I was just moving the bits around. But now that I look back on it, it just feels like a little bit of a work of art, and it makes me feel, oh, it's nice. Sorry, not very deep.
It's okay. We're getting late in the day, I think.
We've
done a fair bit of deep writing.
Okay. Shall we have a bit of royalty?
Bit of royalty.
Okay, all right. This is another dream poem. Now, you'll remember a couple of years ago, that there was a big event at Buckingham Palace. And 300-ish people from the poetry world, all very much at random, were invited to go, not read a poem, but I think shake the Queen's hand and have a glass of wine or something like that. Anyway, there was a bit of a furore, you know, who got invited and who didn't. It was all got a bit itchy.
Which is really surprising, isn't it? Really surprising for poets to get so backbitingly bitchy, competitive.
I know, God, I know, we were... Anyway, it was shocked. Anyway, the night
I wasn't invited, by the way.
The night it happened, I dreamt that at home, we live in Dorset, that we got a call or some communication from Buckingham Palace to say that the Queen was in a bit of a state about something, and she needed a billet for the night. And there was no question of saying no or why or anything. She was just going to arrive. And and in the dream, I was worried about the standard of my housekeeping. And, you know, and also the other thing was that there were two other very close friends actually staying in the house at the time. There was lots more complicated things like sandwiches, which I'll leave. But I mean, this didn't get into the poem. This is called Royal Visit. The Queen arrived late that night, and after several cups of tea, asked to be shown to her room. The communication I'd received from the palace was that her presence would not require any alteration to our plans, and that her only need was to have some privacy at this trying time. Beyond light and regular meals, nothing elaborate was required. They must have given her some idea where she'd be staying. She was no fool. She knew her subjects, and yet... D and M were also staying with us, and you don't ask people to leave just because the Queen is staying with you. In any case, our friends are assets, the kind who do anything to make things go smoothly in whatever circumstances. While we were getting ready for her arrival, M caught me staring at a china dish, one of several, that contained some seashells, a hyacinth bulb, and drill bits. Her expression said, "Just roll with it." And of course, D&M were tickled pink to be sleeping under the same roof. "Think of us as the couple," D said, "like you see in the lady, a benign janitorial presence." A semblance of the protocols having been observed, and the aforementioned cups of tea having been duly drunk, the Queen retired for the night, slept, woke, washed, breakfasted with us wearing a kind of lime green straw sou'wester, and spent the morning in her room with the day's papers, whereupon each one addressed him or herself to his or her allotted task. Towel supply, soap check, bathroom monitoring, hiding rubbish, etc.
I just wanted to say before you read the next one that it's one of those commonplace sayings that there's nothing less interesting than other people's dreams. But actually, one of the things I love about your writing is that you challenge that. Because and what I think is for me is fascinating about that poem is that the way you write and the way it's presented in this absolutely this sort of deadpan. Well, it's not even deadpan. It's actually just a very straightforward style. For me, it then doesn't invite the question, well, I wonder what was going on for Annie. But it starts to bounce back into me and thinking, what would that mean for me if I had that dream?
Yeah.
And it's absolutely apart.
Or if she actually had to come and stay with you, what would you do?
Yeah. What would it be like?
Yeah.
And it has that marvelous sort of reflecting back quality as well, of course, as being just delightfully humorous.
Thank you.
Next one.
Okay, all right. We're doing fine time-wise, by the way.
We're doing fine.
Okay. Okay, another dream poem. About at least more than twice a year, I dream that I find another room in the house. I know a lot. I see a lot of nods. Yep. And it is always fabulous. What happens is there's a door that sort of is there and isn't. You know, like, we live in an old house. There are sort of funny doors here and there's a funny door there. There's a sort of extra door. And somehow the handle gets turned. Wow, there's another room. It's full of character, you know. It tends to be rather disused, sort of a bit dusty maybe. Empty, big, interesting. And I go in and it's like, how did I miss it? How did I not see it? And there it is. And I walk round and I think, oh my God, what can I do? Oh my goodness, look at this. Oh my gosh. And then I wake and it's not there. And, Anyway, it was really exciting writing this poem. I wanted to write this poem long before I ever thought I could write poems, because it's been such a big theme in my life. And of course, what is it about? It's about possibility, isn't it? It's about more than that. This is the room that isn't there. Sometimes I dream I'm in a room that isn't there. The many years I've lived here and not noticed it before. An unexpected boon, such blessed emptiness. It's going to change my life. What shall I use it for? And grey the morning comes, I wake. The rooms are as they were, each one with its function and its mess. And all this time it dwells behind the door, a simulacrum of my mind, my womb, my unlived life, my life to come. Or could it be life's end that brings me here, treading its naked boards, sitting at a table on a wooden chair, and rushing to the window to take in the view, the trees outside, the spring, the blossom on the grass.
Beautiful, thank you. Time precludes it, but there are so many things I want to sort of investigate about that poem. But I suppose just one, maybe a question I had to ask you is because that poem I think seems to point towards it, something about coming to poetry later in life and what that kind of means for you as somebody who's, you know, his first collection was published when you were 50-something?
Yeah, 55 or something.
55?
Yeah, maybe more, I can't remember now.
Yeah. I think poems are rooms that aren't there. In the same way we talk in therapy about, you know, the containing space, there's a physical space, but it's also a psychological space.
Well, it's a bit like the Chinese warriors for me. Mm. It's like, because I didn't begin to be serious about writing until quite late in life, it's like I've got this kind of massed army. Right. You know, they're just there, you know. Like, I've got all sorts of really, really bad self-dialogue about writing. You can't write that. You can't do that. That's too difficult. You can't write that. Never write that. You can't. But then the poem is sort of, come on, you know. And, you know, they sort of break down the door. And it does feel sometimes that it is like having this sort of pressure of material that has made it possible for me. Mm. You know, I don't mean to say it's easy, but sometimes I write a lot in a rush. You know, boom, six poems, in a few days or something. Mm. I mean, and then they need work. But that's one of the aspects of, you know, coming to writing poetry later in life. Mm.
Just before we maybe hear a last poem from the book, I know something again we talked about was. As wanting to look at or something you're very keen to talk about, and this goes back to sort of, you know, fictive personas and the nature of fraud and lying in poetry. And you're talking about it being a frantic profession.
Well,
and a fraudulent profession.
Yeah, you know, sometimes, like, you know, sometimes the bank rings me up and calls me Annie Fraud. They really do. But there's a wonderful book by Saul Bellow called Humboldt's Gift. And because there's been a lot of talk about Bellow lately, because there's been a new biography, I bought Humboldt's Gift. It's American right down to its the last blood cell of every single word. It's so brilliant. It's about the craziness of writing and about how being a writer drives this man into deeper and deeper and more mired craziness with his women and his writing and his publishers and his friends and his gambling and his eating and his smoking and everything and his drugs. And there's a bit where he says that poetry is a frantic profession and that if you, and it's all to do with self-esteem, and if you kind of like yourself, you know, it's going to be okay. But if you kind of fall foul of yourself, you'll fail. You'll be fucked. Mm. And it's really, really well put. And it speaks a lot to me. And I'm not saying this because I like to debunk. No, I like to honour things. But there's an aspect of being a poet, writing poetry, and yes, and people say, what does it mean to be a poet, and what does it mean? And there's an aspect of it for me that always feels I'm getting away with it. Mm-hmm. You know, and like when I go into the pub sometimes, and people say, oh, you know, what you do, and I write poetry, they say, you don't, what a load of shit. And people do have that attitude, mm-hmm. because poetry is meant to be, you know, just a load of rubbish, really. Mm-hmm. And the very, very up themselves people write it. So, although I don't see it at all like that, I cannot escape from that aspect of it.
Mm. And
people don't. And people know about it. You know, like, you know, who was it? Tim Wells, who coined the phrase, tough on poetry, tough on the causes of poetry.
No, and I'm somebody who had a long gap when I didn't write, during which time I worked in mental health and trained as a psychotherapist, and always say that everything I went through, in, you know, the rigorous process of becoming a therapist was sort of like a minimal preparation for the challenges of writing poetry, because it's I certainly find that in terms of pushing you against the coalface of your own process, your own neurosis, your own insecurities, your own self-doubt, actually there's nothing better, if that's the right word, than writing poems, is there?
Except painting pictures, maybe.
Oh, well, I don't even go there. I know you do both. You're multitasking. But, anyway, so should we do one more poem?
One more. Well, I was terribly glad that Beatrice read a poem earlier about working in the public sector. You know, that's always good to kind of get that out of your system. And this poem is called Induction. And I'm sure there are people here who, you know, you start a job and, you know, you have your induction day and, you know, you get an organisational chart and health and safety rules, and you get shown your desk and the plants that you're going to allow to die, and you know, you sort of like you sort of begin to decide who you're going to hate and who you're going to like and all that, and you know, the departmental thingies and the slogan that, you know, governs your practice and everything. Anyway, I had another dream in which I was up for some sort of military service. Not military service, not public service. And what happened is I arrived in this room, and it was a bit like a kind of metal encased area, like a posh lift, no, lifts in a posh department store, all very brushed steel and clean. And this woman came towards me in a sort of uniform with one of those badges, you know, her role. And she told me that I was going to be taken down to the centre of the earth, and that I wasn't to worry. They'd never had something go wrong. They couldn't guarantee it, but they would be in charge, and it would all be fine. And this is the poem. It's called Induction. Oh, just a bit more. After I'd written it, it suddenly occurred to me that so much of life is like this. Like, you know, when you get older, they put you into a sort of polo mint and they photograph you 1,000 times backwards and forwards when you've got a lump somewhere. Or, you know, you go for a job, or you start a new relationship, or you go to a foreign country, very, very hot. That's a new sort of form of induction, isn't it? You hand over control. And so it just seemed to be like induction was everywhere in my life suddenly. Induction. I am here to welcome you and to help you prepare for what is about to happen. I can see that you're hoping that we decided to call it off for today, but I'm afraid that's something we never do. We consider ourselves very lucky that you're here at all, and our years of experience have taught us that it's always better to go ahead as planned. First, at the risk of repeating what has already been said in the letter, you have been personally selected for this by people who know what they're doing. We have no doubt in your ability to cope, and the chances of anything going wrong on the technical front are so minuscule as to render any concern you may have as insignificant. At this point, we usually offer a glass of water, as you won't be taking anything with you once the doors are closed. Secondly, there's the science that governs our practice. There's been some debate in the public domain about why, up to now, we haven't opted for the so-called virtual route and looked at ways of mimicking reality. The consensus is that absolutely nothing beats real human beings. The richness of their emotional responses, their capacity for facing the unknown, it's truly humbling. And our concern for the integrity of any data we gather is genuine. In return, our job is infinitely more rewarding, knowing that we're doing our utmost to secure your cooperation and make you as comfortable as possible. I think that's everything covered. If you would kindly undress in one of our cubicles, your protective clothing is ready for you to put on.
Thank you very much. So I know some people have to catch trains, so we'll just quietly them do that. That's okay. Thank you for coming. Goodbye. So, first of all, has anyone got any questions for... okay, so...
I'd be interested in how your poems were laid out, because in contrast to some of the others that we've heard today, yours read very, very much as a narrative. The structure sounds like a short story, a piece of flash fiction almost, rather than the kind of line-by-line poetry with rhythms between the lines. I'm just wondering how you lay out your poems and whether that's a choice that you make or not.
I do write stanzaic poetry as well that rhymes and things like that. But I kind of obey the dictates of the material. I want it to look kind of lovely on the page. I want my line endings to feel, to give you a sort of frisson, or not, if it's not appropriate. I mean, I don't want a shock just for the sake of it. I see my poems as sort of short films, really. And I began my writing career by writing film scripts. I wrote some really good film scripts, but I didn't quite know how to go about getting them made into films. And writing poetry seemed not to require millions and millions and millions of pounds. And so it was just easier. Well, easier, you know, more... I took more responsibility by writing poems than sort of endlessly being miserable that I could never make any films.
Could you share with us when you know the poem's finished? I mean, what is that process like?
When it's really finished, or when the first draft's finished?
Well, what is it? The whole process,
I'd
be very interesting.
Oh, right, okay. When I know a poem is finished, I suppose I sort of feel a kind of like a nervous excitement. When it's on page and I feel... because often the process of kind of correcting and making it better can be really quite wearing and dreary and endless, and you know, your sort of 18th version is just revolting, whereas the first one was a delight. But it's you know, it's, you feel a certain kind of nervous excitement, I suppose. I suppose here's a very short one. I was given a commission to write something about the word 40. It was to do with Picador being 40 years old, and I simply couldn't do it. The deadline passed, and I wrote endless pleading emails, and I went sort of beat myself up in the loo, and you know, I couldn't do it. And then I went and did a little drawing, and I realised that this was what I was meaning. I drew this picture to avoid saying anything about 40. I have always hated numbers. Thinking about them is torture. They make me feel I'm going mad. They're like swastikas to me. Mm. It's like finding a kind of truth that is exciting. That, you know, gives me a sort of nervous feeling of.
And I mean, another excellent example of the how commissions can force you into saying an unexpected truth.
Yes. It's like going to court almost.
Yes.
Tell the whole truth, the truth, or nothing but the truth. So help me God.
That was very entertaining, thank you, and inspiring lots of ideas, and also actually brought things up from my own unconscious, such as other rooms that I dreamt about and had completely forgotten I dreamt about them. And I'm just interested in this idea that you called this session the room that isn't there, and Alan was talking about therapy seeing using the idea of rooms in the mind as well. I wondered if you could expand on that a little bit. It just struck me as also chiming a little bit with what Soen was saying in the previous session about the modularity of our model of the mind now and the lobes. And I'm seeing links between sort of neurology here and the mind.
Yeah,
and chambers.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can't wax too lyrical about my lobes. But there is that feeling. There is that feeling that something's busting through. It's like, you know, you get this sort of idea. It feels completely impermissible. It feels completely redundant. It feels completely fraudulent. But there's something exciting, like a kind of like something on a cooking on a stove. And it's like, you know, we put cake in the oven, it's sort of gloop, and then you take it out to this wonderful sponge. And it's like there's a kind of transformative, the pressure of the imaginative life just gets too much, so you think, well, just write the damn thing. That's what I'm going to say.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that just in response to the piece about rooms. I mean, it's a different metaphor for the same process, I think. But it's back to the Frostian thing about a momentary stay against confusion. You know, and poems I think of as these little rooms that are artificial constructs by which, for a moment, we believe we have some mastery over what we cannot master. And going back to, I mean, you mentioned Muldoon, who I think he talked about. All that he really hoped for from a poem was that it was like a room that you go into, and that you leave it slightly clearer about the world. You know, that's all he wants. You know, but in that sort of small gaining of a little clarity, that's enough to live by.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes.
But yes, of course, as I say, there are rooms that are strictly speaking not there.
I was just thinking in relation to the neuroscience, what we say to our parents in our information sessions, psychoeducation sessions, is that neuroscience tells us that the same areas of the brain in which we think about our own emotional experiences or in which we feel pain are the same areas that light up in the neuroimaging studies when we witness someone we care about in pain or thinking about their emotions. And so we encapsulated to say, so the rooms in your mind in which you perhaps have shut the doors on losses in the past means that your children can't access that, and you're going to be unable to therefore mirror or understand their loss at separation, for instance. Hence, we need to do some work together. That's what we say. Okay.
It's not meant to sound flippant in any way, but I'm wondering, would you ever consider a collection of poetry called London Modern Cheeses?
No, I wouldn't.
You didn't see that as something that...
No, that's not where... it's slightly tempting, but it's like they feel like going backwards. Yeah.
It's a wonderful title.
Yeah.
And I know that if I saw that on a bookshelf, I would be immediately drawn to it.
Do you know, G.K. Chesterton has said that poets have remained mysteriously silent on the subject of cheese.
Hi, I was interested in what you said about there should be two frightened people in the consulting room.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, when you write a poem, does that in some way lance the boil in a way, and then you go into the therapy room and it's all sort of, it's dealt with, or does it enhance it? Almost like writing the poem is going to therapy, but just with your sort of pen and paper.
I mean, sort of touching in on what Beatrice talked about earlier about where there are overlaps between the two professions, and I think there are overlaps. I wrote an article about creative poetry and creativity and the unconscious, which is up on the Magma Poetry website. I think it's not so much for me about lancing a boil. I would agree with Annie that there's a sense of what one brings to the blank page is not dissimilar, I think, sometimes to what the client brings to the therapy session, which is a sense of pressure that at some point will somehow break through what in Gestalt we would term the impasse, you know, the impulse not to say and the impulse to speak. But it's maybe less lancing a boil, but I like to think of it more as the creation of something that is, to the conscious mind anyway, is wholly new. So I think that's more the kind of phrasing I put around it, rather than something that's sort of relief catharsis. It's about something that is created anew.
I wanted to add something to that about sort of like the unavoidable thinking in response to what your question. And I've got a commission to write quite a big piece about winter. It's good, needs to be upbeat and something else. And I sort of think, well, there are various things about winter that are simply unavoidable, that I'm going to, and it's like not being able to dodge them. So it's having to face, you know, like if I'm going to write this poem, and I'm going to have to sort of face up to thinking about my feelings about winter, and you know, am I going to start talking about bare branches and things like that, and you know, the cold and the days being short, you know.
Thank you. I think we probably have time for maybe one more question as we wrap up the day. Does anyone wish to be the final person? Ooh. No, let's leave it there. Okay, Beatrice, go on.
It's not a question. I just wonder if Annie might read another poem.
A quickie?
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you mean a poem?
Yeah.
I think it's, we have one class in reserve.
Oh, Zaluzianskaya.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I write a lot of poems when I'm driving, because I mean, literally. But what happens is I see something out the window, or I hear something on the radio, and it's as I'm driving, it's a lot of time for reflection, and I was driving to a place called Sutton Bingham. It's a very beautiful place. It has these great enormous reservoirs with a causeway in the middle. And I was looking for a way of taking my husband on a fishing trip. So I was going up there as a bit of reconnoitring and checking out. And Gardener's Question Time was on the radio. And somebody was asking for a plant that did a certain thing. And one of the people on the panel said, well, what you want to do is you want to get some Zaluzianskaya. All along the road to Sutton Bingham, I kept saying your name, Zaluzianskaya, Zaluzianskaya, so as not to forget it. I'd never heard anything so voluptuous. The way they talked about you on the radio, your vanilla fragrance, your origins in the Drakensberg Mountains, perhaps I'd once trodden on you. Your double-lobed petals coloured crimson on the underside. I kept thinking, when I get home, I'm going to find out everything there is to know about you. I'm going to buy seeds and grow pots of you along all the windowsills. I gripped the steering wheel and laughed, and I hadn't even seen you. It would be like having a child in the house again. With a name like that, you would have been a bold revolutionary girl, throwing stones at the totalitarians, telling the truth about everything. Everyone would have wanted to know you. Everyone would have wanted to be on your side. Everyone would have wanted to call out your name. Zaluzianskaya.
Thank you very much indeed, Alan Buckley and Annie Freud and Soane Park. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I just have a couple of just closing things to say. Do enter the National Poetry Competition. Beatrice Garland has won it, so let that be a lesson to you. There is a form at the back. She might win it again. Who knows? There are other events, but there are leaflets about those. Rita Dove, the Poetry Society annual lecture, the next Freud Museum events. Do, if you are not a member, join the Freud Museum. Do, if you are not a member, join the Poetry Society, when you can visit the Poetry Society basement and discover just quite how much brushed steel and glamour there is in the world, for those of you who haven't visited. Do give Mike your feedback forms, tell us your thoughts so that we can put on more events and give you what you'd like to hear. A big thank you to Jerry Byrne and Ivan Ward and all of your colleagues at the Freud Museum. Thank you for your marvellous questions and for your attention, and to every speaker we've had today. I've so much enjoyed it. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.